Chapter 44.
The woods sang a song Kip had never known. The ponderosas swayed and shyly sighed as frogs croaked in chaotic chorus, descants of squirrels soaring high above all like preening sopranos, while the wind danced past, her tresses brushing his cheek as she spun, leafy skirts flaring, willowy legs flashing. The evening chill held him back from the floor, putting a hand upon his thudding heart. "Be still, my dear, be still." The last drop of rain pressed a shushing finger across his lips. Made pliant by the rain's caresses, the earth pulled back her leafy covers like a beckoning lover, and the scent of their love filled the house of sky.
"Kip," Con Arthur whispered. "My lord, are you well?"
Kip came back to himself.
"I'm eccentric, Con Arthur," he said very quietly. "Eccentric. Not crazy."
"Never mistook you for concentric, sir,"
Kip grinned. "A wit in a bear." On the other hand, he was probably the last person who should judge a person's mind by the flesh suit it wore. They were fanning out through the woods here as the late afternoon passed, looking for signs of the spy. They had docked not 20 paces back, and it had taken only that much distance for Kip to be overwhelmed by a sense of homecoming. Not his own homecoming. Daewon Webb's. He nodded to Con Arthur, and spreading out with 20 others for a distance of 300 paces, they began ghosting through the woods. Daewon Webb was from a village long lauded for its skillful hunters. Among the best of them, there was a test, an impossible test, to sneak up on a deer and touch it with your bare hand. Many young men tried for years, learning everything from their elders about scent and silence and silhouettes and the sweet subterfuge of stalking. They meditated on water and wind and all the ways of the wood and weather. They became satraps of silence, cons of camouflage, paragons of patience, and friends of frustration. Those were all traits invaluable to the master hunters they became, for on the path that led to that test and that failure, they were moulded into the greatest stalkers known to man. And this time, unlike any other time he'd been in the cards, Kip could remember exactly how Webb did what he did. As he moved through the woods, though, it became clear that remembering the mechanics of an action was different from learning it in your own body. Moving silently was itself the culmination of dozens of discrete skills, practiced separately and then together for so long that the stalker could do them without thinking. Scouting was a set of different but parallel skills, paying attention to the wind, to the sounds of the animals, knowing each kind and knowing to what each kind reacted and how. This bird goes silent when it notices animals. This kind takes flight when a predator or outsider is within this distance. These squirrels turn toward those they scold. To pay attention to all those while tracking and using scent as well was simply beyond Kip. By living the card, and remembering all that was in it, he was instantly twice as adept as he had been before. He could now understand what made the master masterful, but that didn't make him a master himself. Kip could suddenly identify all the smells in his nostrils, but his nose wasn't as naturally keen as Webb's, nor his body so light and lean. Webb could bend branches with a step that Kip's big tread would crush. But what a man. Webb's first hand brush against a deer's flank had been partly luck. While he'd been stalking the deer, a running javelina had started it toward him, so he'd not had to close the last 10 impossible feet by stealth. Another man would have taken his bragging rights and never looked back. Webb had instead redoubled his efforts. This at 14 years of age. He'd succeeded twice more by the time he was 16, and when a rival called him a liar for his claims, no hunter had ever succeeded 3 times. Webb had left his village with only a knife and gone to stalk the legendary white stag. It took him a month of living on bugs and berries, but he'd slain it with one stroke of his knife. He'd dragged the body, intact, not gutted, all the leagues back to his village so that none could deny he'd taken the white stag with only a knife. For anyone else, taking a white stag at all would have been a tale to tell for the rest of his life. When Webb had arrived at his village, he'd found it burnt to cinders by the advancing Blood Robe army. Nearly everyone was dead. The famed hunters could have fled, but none had been content to leave the old and the young and the infirm to die. They'd stayed, they'd fought, and they'd been massacred by the Blood Robes. Only a few cowards had fled. Webb hunted the cowards first, including the man who had called him a liar. Now he stalked the Blood Robes in the deep woods of Western Blood Forest. In military terms, his killings didn't make much of a strategic difference. He killed only one man or one white at a time, and always used only his knife or his bare hands. He spent days setting up a strike, and his target would simply disappear. But not disappear forever. A camp of the White King's men had woken one morning to find their kidnapped leader in the middle of their own camp. He was skinned, gutted, his throat cut, and hanging upside down from a tree limb, as meat is hung to cure by a butcher. The men in that camp weren't simple foreign soldiers with lax discipline. They were locals who knew the land here. They were the White King's best scouts. Dywin Webb had murdered their leader simply to embarrass them. From time to time, he would show up in friendly villages or towns laden with gems or gold or coin sticks he'd taken from his kills. He would give these to the town's con. He wanted nothing in return, not even the steel fish hooks or sugar, or salt or whiskey that other long-term trappers or hunters would have traded for. He simply gave them the valuables because he knew they would need money to rebuild their lives, and he would tell them the disposition of the White King's forces and the direction in which they were heading, usually toward that village. He asked for nothing and seemed not to care if they heeded his advice. He spoke with a gentle voice and then disappeared. He became like a forest creature, and his eyes were soft and skittish, not what you would expect of a predator who skinned and gutted men. He was content to live alone, and he had become a beast. And now Kip was doing his best to emulate him, though it was more and more obvious that he had too much confidence that he could ape such perfection, moving through the dusky woods searching for the red, white beef. This white was so far into his transformation that Kip suddenly smelled him. The tobacco and tea leaves scent of his red luxin and the slight whiff of smoke. Kip veered off his assigned line in the darkness, so intent on the hunt and the thousand skills needed to track silently that he didn't even tell Cruxer. A pocket valley opened off to one side, far from the hunting ground the ghosts had suggested, and as night settled on the deep forest, Kip's options were being shut down. He'd packed blue luxin before the evening light faded, setting all the blue lines in the turtle bear tattoo aglow, but it was uncomfortable to hold packed luxin for long, and it slowly leaked away regardless, like sand through cupped hands. His turtle bear now looked faded as a 50-year-old tattoo. Kip did have a bow, but he wasn't much of a shot. He couldn't have lived an archer's card, could he? Nah, that would have been far too helpful. Of course, at least one of the people in the cards must have been an amazing archer. More than one, surely, with so many warriors represented. In fact, Webb himself had to be more than competent with a bow, but did Kip really want to sift Dywin Webb's memories further? The first thing that came to mind when he pulled those memories farther off the shelf was the sight of the charred bodies of Webb's favourite little cousins. No thanks. The next great warrior Kip could easily recall was Tremblefist, and though Kip had nothing but compassion for the man who'd lived and died a hero, fair or not, the memory that leapt out was of the butcher of Ugbalu. Double no thanks. Kip came over a rise and knew that something was wrong. You can't let your mind wander while you're tracking. He'd defaulted to being his overthinking self, and now the white was gone and Kip was alone. In his reverie, Kip hadn't even realized how he'd picked up the trail. Maybe Dywin Webb had sunk in deeper than he'd realized. That didn't matter now. Too much thinking. In cresting of the rise, he'd skylined himself, putting his darker silhouette against the lighter forest behind him. He dropped to his face lightly, landing on fingertips and toes so he wouldn't make any more noise than necessary. A whoosh ripped through the jungle as a fireball streaked over his head. Kip rolled to the side to get behind a tree, trying to find the white. The creature that had once been Baith was smart enough not to stand out in the open with a flaming hand. It was a monochrome red, so it needed an open flame to have lit the fireball. It might have a flint and steel to scratch sparks onto each flammable missile, but that was like a musketeer going into battle with musket unloaded. Few warriors were daring enough to trade strength for stealth, especially not passionate reds. As he moved back to the crest of the hill, Kip guessed at the fireball's trajectory from where he'd been standing and where the fireball had hit the trees behind him. In the gloaming, the spotty light the trees allowed through their swaying branches made it near impossible. Then he saw a constant, low light illuminating the leaves dimly from below. It was somewhat off to the side from the origin he'd guessed. The white was moving, trying to circle Kip. Kip got behind the crest of the hill and ran to the side, flanking the entire hill. That much light cast upward? That meant the red-white was keeping a flame smaller than his palm. And probably in his palm. Kip's studies had told him exactly how much sizzling and popping a flame of that size would make, and thus how loud it would be over this distance, in this jungle that he knew so intimately. Kip could guess exactly how much noise his own passage through the undergrowth could make without the white's hearing him. Within half a minute, he'd flanked the white, who was now moving stealthily toward where Kip had been. Faith had further banked the flame he carried, making his right hand an inverted bowl like a hooded lantern. How was he drafting so much with this light, though? And then Kip saw how, and he was baffled that no one had ever explained it. The white was drafting off himself. That must be at least part of why whites transformed themselves. This white had copious amounts of imperfect red luxin encasing his entire body, so he could flash it back into red light that he could then draft. It was inefficient to draft from broken luxin, but this meant a white could never be trapped powerless in darkness. Effectively, it carried its own mag torches in its body, and come daylight, it could easily replenish itself. The mighty, like all the Chromeria, had discounted the accounts they'd heard of nighttime attacks. Drafters would never attack at night, they thought. They'd thought wrong, and it could have been a disastrous mistake. But too much thinking, again. Kip had lost the blue in all his running and loss of concentration. The fletching of his arrows had been fouled with mud from his roll on the ground. How accurate would they be? He swapped through the spectacles on his left hip, drafting some superviolet, he didn't need much, and then some red, each colour sending a new glimmer of light into the turtle bear tattoo. In sub-red, Kip looked for any forest creatures. All I need is just one squirrel, damn it. But there were none. Have to do this the old-fashioned way. With his left hand, he pushed a veritable ice carpet of superviolet webbing forward through the undergrowth. Superviolet was so light and weak that any particular strand of it could break easily, so he took the Gavin Gile approach. More is better. He needed only one continuous section to project his will through the luxin. With his right hand, he picked up a rock and threw it deep into the woods off to one side. It was unlike his usual Kipliness that this time he didn't hit the first branch and spoil the whole effect. The whisper of the falling rock in the undergrowth froze the white, who looked first for an attack and then for prey. The pause was long enough. Kip's web of superviolet spread as far as the red-white's feet, up its ankles and to the inevitable seams between the solid luxin plates of its feet and its calves. A man wasn't made to have an exoskeleton. Skin moved and flexed in ways that solid plates didn't allow. The solutions most whites came up with were taken directly from armourers, painstakingly articulated joints, or chainmail meshes, or bulky straps and prayer. This white was floating an entire layer of open red luxin underneath his armour so that he could use it for fuel, and so his skin could move. With his left hand seeking the open red luxin, Kip reached his will through the superviolet, while his right hand sent a tiny bolus of a fire crystal through the superviolet toward his target. Every plate of the white's armor would have knots, places where the magic had been sealed. Naturally, they would be on the protected inside. Kip was planning to unknot all the plates at once, but before he could reach them, the white started to move. Kip threw his will hard into the white's open red luxin. He pulled it all toward the white's chest, twisting hard. Its chest plate cracked with a snap at the same moment the fire crystal reached the white's feet. Kip popped the fire crystal up and exposed to the air, the crystal flared and sparked. Covered completely in a mess of open red luxin, the white went up in flames. But that wasn't enough. Kip ran forward, knocking an arrow. The white reacted first, as a man would, slapping at the flames, terrified, so it wasn't so far gone yet, or so smart. He could have drafted off his own flames and covered himself in more and more red luxin until it made a crust. It was difficult to burn a red drafter to death, if he was thinking. Kip couldn't give Beeth time to think. He loosed the first arrow a mere 10 paces away. Drew another, loosed it. Drew another, loosed. The white screamed, a pillar of fire in the dark woods. He flung out a hand and Kip leapt aside. A gout of flaming, oily red luxin went out from the white, splattering and burning trees and bushes in a wide arc. It passed over Kip's head. Then, weakening, the white threw one more burst of liquid death upward. By the time the flaming goo dropped to the ground, the white was dead. It had become a charred pillar of blackened Luxin,
still burning patches of red Luxin and steaming bits of seared human flesh and white bone peeking out like gore candles.
Within minutes, drawn by Kip's oh-so-subtle signal fire, the Mighty arrived, along with Con Arthur and a few trackers.
"So,"
the Con said, looking around the forest punctuated with burning clumps of red Luxin around this epicenter of destruction.
"I'm guessing you didn't get the scrolls he was carrying."
"Ah, shit," Kip said.